City, John Grayson and Rob Ross with you once again on PopDose.com, doing some talking about the things going on both here and elsewhere in the world. And Rob Ross, how are you?
I am doing well, John. How are you this week?
Not bad, not bad. But like the rest of the world, I think I've been a little bit embarrassed about what's been going on in Donald Trump's world tour and what's been going on here at home while he's been gone. It's been an absolute mess. And I guess to nobody's real surprise, it doesn't look like it's going to get any better.
The frustration that mounts in my mind, in my gut, really, ever since he's taken over the presidency, just seems to heighten with every new report that comes along. And I want to preface this by saying I'm already really tired of the way that the press and a lot of people in general go about with their hand-wringing and their overboard attacks of Trump. And I say that not in defense of him, but in a case of, we know exactly what he's doing.
Right.
You don't have to put on the histrionics and the act of moral indignation about it.
Every time. Yeah.
Right. It's such an overreaction to everything. So that does not help matters any. This is a time for rational people to be thinking and acting accordingly. Not act like school children saying, see, he's doing this, he's doing that. We know.
Yep.
We get it. We understand. We're witnessing this, unfortunately. Now, having started with that little tirade, my next tirade will be to carry on what you were just talking about as far as the Trump very brief world tour number one, which I found to be appalling. The raging hypocrisy in which he addressed the Palestinians, then the next round of raging hypocrisy in which he addressed the Israelis. I'm not going to mince my words, and I'm not going to lie. Trump has been bullshitting Bibi Netanyahu from the get-go. Jared Kushner, who we'll get to in a moment, is an embarrassment
yep.
and a farce yep. as far as him being quote-unquote an Orthodox Jew goes. I'm not going to be accepting of that, nor am I going to buy any of it. Just the way Trump acts visually and the way he speaks on that world stage is just such an embarrassment. Start with that and then work your way into even greater depths of despair and anger and frustration, because everything the man touches just turns into absolute shit.
Yeah.
It's dog and pony show that's just nauseating and then some. And of course, then we have the incident that occurred in Portland, Oregon, on the public transport system in which two Muslim girls were being harassed by what seems to be a supporter of the white nationalist movement, and was asked by three people to leave them alone, and two of those people who asked wound up being stabbed to death by this person.
Yeah, and the other one was in critical condition at last check.
Right. So this is all part and parcel of making America great again. This is Trump's America. This is no one else's. This is Trump's. This is his responsibility in the overall scope, because he is the, unfortunately, sitting president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And the response, I mean, you talk about the responsibility, that's one thing, but the response from the White House has been silence. I mean, nothing. No acknowledgement that the incident even happened, which is disgusting in and of itself. But you go back to the other things that have happened over the course of just the last few days, and, you know, you get the guy in Montana who goes to Congress right after body slamming a reporter, and gets a $100,000 donation the day after that story breaks. And it just goes to show that I think what's beginning to happen, for the longest time, there was a level at which you could be an asshole and be in politics. It was almost expected, but you couldn't go beyond that. And now, if you did, you were done. You just had to leave and go find something else to do. But now it's to the point where there seems to be a level at which you have to be. And if you don't reach that, if you're not enough of an asshole, you're going to get beat. And I don't understand how that flip happened, but you're right. I think that what it's done is it's set up a
it's a free-for-all now.
Yeah.
The floodgates have been opened. What you were describing right now is what I guess what we could consider you had to be an asshole with dignity.
Right,
Once upon a
right.
time, the old Republican Guard. But now it seems any piece of walking human garbage can run for office and win. I mean, for God's sakes, right here in my own home of Staten Island, they had reelected an indicted criminal.
Right, right.
So Michael Grimm was already indicted, and they still reelected the fucking guy, which wound up costing the most important thing of all, which nobody stopped to think about, costing the taxpayers, everyone, Republicans and Democrats alike, millions of dollars to hold a special election after he was sentenced.
Right.
It could have been avoided, but no, they went ahead and reelected the guy.
Yeah, and you know, with the Jared Kushner thing, and we'll get into some of the details on this, but I think it's been fascinating to watch. Some of the people that I know already are defenders at all costs of Donald Trump, of all things Republican. I mean, the ones who are go team, the tribalists that we were talking about last week. And I've been watching them, and I think, okay. Every time, the only thing interesting to me about this is when the media go insane about the latest thing that happened, is how the Trumpites are going to defend it. And in this case, with Jared Kushner, it's been crazy to watch because now what they do is they take something that they bitched about at the time and say, but you guys did this. And in this case, it's been Kennedy. Well, John Kennedy had back-channel communications with the Russians during the Cuban Missile Crisis, as though that's in any arena the same. And when they found out he did it the first time, they said, ah, fucking Democrats.
You know, it was funny this morning. I was watching a snippet of MSNBC, and they had Howard Dean on. And they asked him, and keep in mind, you know, I take anything that anyone on MSNBC says with a grain of salt
Sure.
now. But they asked him, do you think what, you know, what Kushner's machinations with these back channel deals with the Russians is a good thing or a bad thing? He goes, it's a bad thing, and anybody else who would have done it would be tried for treason.
Yep.
Hallelujah.
Right.
Magic words were finally spoken without any kind of grandeur. He made it right to the point. Technically, Kushner is not a member of the federal government,
Right.
but he's working for his father-in-law, who happens to be the sitting president, who has full working knowledge of what he is doing. And I think it's pretty well documented through the annals of history that even if you have a knowledge of somebody else's misdoings that could be considered treasonous, you too shall in fact be tried for said act.
Yeah. And as far as Kennedy is concerned, he was doing it to try to avoid nuclear annihilation. He wasn't doing it to try to make himself and his family richer. There's a little bit of a gulf there, I think, in terms of motivation.
Very, very true. So, you know, now we have to sit back and wait and watch and listen again. God have mercy on us, because the listening is just getting so out of control and tedious as they bullshit their way and try, not successfully, but they try to double speak the excuses that go along for everything that Trump and everyone directly aligned with him says and or does.
Yeah.
A bright news note, as far as, you know, the media goes, apparently Breitbart's numbers are tanking.
Really?
That's what the report was this morning. I wish I could remember the source. It's a credible source. It is in one of these little blogs or, you know, ultra left wing reporting services. No, it's one of the more legitimate news services. For next week's show, I'll try to have the article on hand
Yeah.
just so we can touch upon it.
I don't even pay attention to what they're doing anymore, so I don't know if they've softened their stance and they're spinning off the crazies or what. But yeah, as long as fewer people are paying attention to them, I think that's good news. We do have a whole bunch more going on though, and again, Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you. It's Radio City, and we come to you every week here on popdose.com. And there's a lot going on in the music world that we've got to get to, and a couple of things that you, Rob Ross, have reviewed on Popdose that we're going to kick off with, because the brand new one from Anton Barbeau I thought was absolutely one of the more interesting things that I've heard in many, many months. Tell us a little bit about what we have here.
That's kind of hard to describe because it's so broad, which I think is a wonderful thing about it. Anton is definitely, and I don't think I'm out of line saying this, he's a disciple of Robin Hitchcock and of Sid Barrett. There's really no, there's no way around it, and he's probably going to take that as a compliment, I'm sure, because it's meant to be so. You know, people bristle when they're compared to one artist or another, and try as you might, you can't avoid it. It's a wonderful mix of very heady, what I'd like to call space pop. I think that would be a good way of phrasing it, really, because it's got that psychedelic nature. It's got some very pastoral feels to it. You know what it is? It's such a wonderful mixture that there's one thing you can't pinpoint it with. At the end of the day, it's all pop.
Son of Dracula, I've seen the script, I know the makeup man. There's rats and bats and stuff inside the crypt, inside the cleanup van, and with the stake right through the heart to burst a bright red blood balloon. I knew the sun reflected on its satellite. I knew, has death affected you, your appetite?
Took the really quirky side of, let's say, Andy Partridge and teamed him up with Robin Hitchcock and Sid Barrett and Bowie and Bolan, okay, and threw that in. I think that's where you finally get a better grasp of what I'm trying to say. But, you know, first and foremost, I should say that this album came out early last year and it wound up in my very massive pile of CDs. So I'm terribly late in delivering the review and now talking about it. But he's a fantastic singer, songwriter. Give a listen to him. I mean, just to give you some of these songs, Milk Churn in the Morning, which is definitely, I mean, that without a question is a Robin Hitchcock kind of delivery. You know, it's got that lyrical weirdness, and he does that thing that Hitchcock always does. It's this, it's not your standard Peter Buck styled arpeggios, but rather the more delicate kind where you finger pick your way down and up. If you're familiar with Robin Hitchcock songs, something like even though this one's an acoustic one, Sounds Great When You're Dead, you know, or just some of the other things that Hitchcock tends to do, but it's got that kind of feel to it. Now, I'm going to take you out on a really good one. Heavy Psychedelic Toilet. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's a, you know, it's a psychedelic piece with some really brilliant lyrical twists. I mean, the most striking lyrics are, "The face of God is a three-eyed girl in a psychedelic toilet."
Very nice.
But at the same time, the opening of the track is really, it's got that kind of big prog opening, you know? But then it starts to get a little more sinister instead of being what you would think it would become, frankly. You know, when I listened to it and I went back and I re-listened to it because it was a track that stayed with me, I kept thinking, if I was writing this song, and this is what makes the song work as well as it does, I wouldn't have done that opening with the chord progression that he used. I would have made it more, see Emily play, or I am the walrus, you know, or you know, cheese and onions. But
Always a Ruddles reference.
well, do I have to spell it out for you? I mean, really.
Well, you know, and what I dug, you talked about the guitar work and the arpeggios and the coolness of that. But the other thing that struck me was the over-under nature of the harmonies, where in one of the songs I listened to during the verses, the harmony was the high part. And then he get to the chorus and it's a low, almost a sort of a John Lennon, you know, single note harmony underneath it. And that shift came off really well, and that kind of vocal play I thought was really good, and it added a lot to the song.
What I think makes him so much more powerful with what he does is the fact that he's an incredible arranger, you know, and certainly when you know how to arrange your own songs in such detail, it just brings it up a completely different level. You know, you're listening to it and you're enjoying it, but then you're starting to get into it more and picking it apart. And when you start to pick it apart and you hear the nuances, that's when it becomes a lot more of an adventure, and it becomes a lot more fun.
That's
it's almost kind of like listening to, you know, the Blood Rush Hour.
Right. Yeah, because that's when geeks like you and me get really excited about things. Rob Ross and John Grayson here with you again. It's a little thing we call Radio City, and we move from Anton Barbeau, and I'm going to have to ask you on this one, because I don't know if this is the French pronunciation Rancour or if we Americanize this to Kim Rancourt.
It's Kim Rancourt. He's a wonderful person. I have known him for 27 years. Were it not for Kim Rancourt, the Punchline would never have been on the R.E.M. tribute album Surprise Your Pig, because Kim was a member of that late lamented, glorious, and oft forgotten band When People Were Shorter and Lived Near the Water.
Okay.
Their finest hour was their complete reworking and delivery of Porgy and Bess, just simply titled Porgy. Kim has now set forth with his debut solo album after so many years in the music industry, and it's a wonderful, fun, lively mixture of, and I will immediately beg forgiveness in advance because I know it's very hip and trendy to bring this name up, but it's a mixture of Captain Beef, in my mind, Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band, the Stooges, garage rock, you know, just...
Yeah.
It's so lively.
There's a rawness to it, though. Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
And there's some, I don't want to call it Minutemen-isms, but definitely Mike Watt-like stylings because of, A, his vocal delivery and some of the freeform styles that go into this. If you've listened to Firehose and Mike Watt's solo material, it's not dissimilar.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. But it's a fun record, and God knows we need something like that right now. but it's also quite an all-star. I mean, just to give you some of the names on this record, how about Steve Shelley of Sonic Youth playing drums?
Mm-hmm.
Gary Lucas, who is a guitar god, especially in New York, who was in fact a member of the Magic Band. Don Fleming, you know, or the fact that it was produced by Albert Bouchard of the Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of influence from a lot of directions.
That's some heavy shit right there.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys are some heavy cats. You know, I don't think I could get through sessions of that nature when you've got players of that ilk, you know, cause I'd be really overwhelmed. Now, the great thing is Kim Rancourt is so well known and so well loved by so many people that it's not hard to fathom him playing with these folks. I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it is good music for its own sake is fine with me.
Yeah, and that's the great thing. You know, I'm going to give you just a couple of examples so that way people, you know, will hip themselves to it and hopefully pick up on it and listen to it. But, you know, again, I brought up Captain Beefheart a couple of times, but there's a track on there called I Kissed Pat Place, a tribute to the guitarist of the Bush Tetras, who is in fact a brilliant guitarist. And it is that mix of, well, it's the perfect melding of the Minutemen and Beefheart, you know. There's a track called Hail, which is a spoken word piece. And it's got a kind of, and you'll know what I mean when I say it, it's kind of got that mystery film, slasher film kind of sound to it, that creepy, somebody's following me, paranoia-induced kind of track. And then Circles Gotta Go, I think, is probably my favorite because it's just, as I called it, an exercise in hilariously controlled insanity.
And maybe we can think about circles like we should, like round, yes, like yeah, like we know. The circle has to go. Circle has to go. Circle has to go. It's gotta go now. And many of you know that the circle has to go. Poetry and sunshine. Circles gotta go.
Starts off yelling and then ends up screaming. it's great, and that's what makes this such a fun record, because you don't know what to expect. You don't know what's coming around the corner. And so I know he's been around for a long time, but I'm awfully glad to see him finally deliver something under his own name, because it's really long overdue. So hats off to Kim Rancourt. Check this record out. It's going to make you smile, laugh, and I guarantee you it's going to make you tap your foot.
Excellent. So again, more new stuff out, and you can find the review of Kim Rancourt's new effort online at popdose.com under Rob Ross's byline. And one last from you this week as we go into the Pinkerton raid. And before you get started, I want to say there is a thing that happened as the 60s turned to the 70s. There was a production style that got, for a short period of time, very wide. And you had bands like the Association who used it, and it showed up in a couple of different places that I dug, and I didn't think it was around long enough to really explore itself. But when I started listening to the Pinkerton Raid, I was like, I know these kids, I know what they listened to when they were 5, 6, and 7 years old.
Are you thinking of maybe Kurt Becher's style of what they now call sunshine pop?
Exactly.
You know, the Emmett Rhodes school of you know, artistry and production and arrangement.
Right.
Because certainly the Association were produced by Kurt Becher. In fact, I think he did work with Emmett Rhodes. You know, that's a really interesting slant on it, because that wasn't my takeaway on it. But now that you've brought that up, I may have to go back and listen to the album and you know, see if it's really there, because Sunshine Pop was, in fact, one of the most blinking you missed it kind of moments.
Yep.
I don't think anybody, well, it certainly wasn't called that then. But now it's something that people have gone back to revisit.
Started with the wild flower, tickle your face. What if the skin of his fingers had invaded the space between a lonely girl who kept love at arm's length and an eager boy who thought he had the strength to overcome your guard and climb the tower to your heart to find love.
This was an album that I have to admit it was a little difficult at first for me to get into, because it was so far removed from my wheelhouse. Although I don't, at this stage, I don't even know what my wheelhouse is
right
anymore. I was a little leery at first because I was almost afraid it was going to be twee. And I mean, come on, the album title is Tolerance Ends, Love Begins. And right away, I kind of got that. You know, God, I hope this is not something like, God, what are some of those terrible bands from the early 90s? You know, those really do-gooder type bands.
Uh-huh.
That did that kind of world music shit just for the sake of, look at us, we're politically correct.
Yeah, yeah. Look, you know, look how tolerant we are of everything, sure.
You know, we're trying to be talking heads, but we can never be that existential. You know, by that time, talking heads meant absolutely nothing to the rest of the world, but, you know, just that whole, well, anyway, I'm not even trying to rack my brain at this point.
The only, I'll give you a hand, the only band that I liked that came out of that movement that I thought really did have something interesting to say was Rusted Root.
Yeah, but take it in context, you know, these were also the same dumb white fuckers with dreadlocks and, you know, dope-smoking morons, but, you know, okay, I'm glad to say I was wrong.
Yes.
You know, initial instinct was wrong. You know, this band, who is from Durham, North Carolina, actually, it's got that really great mixture of what I actually like. Pop, the rural sounds, rock, and poetry. You know, there are some songs that just really go on a limb, like Hollywood. It's very powerful, but it's in semi-waltz time.
Right.
And I love when people do things like that, because you don't expect it. When they do the unexpected, my interest grows exponentially. You know, Don't has this great mix of guitars and organ, and it makes it a dark musical background to a perfectly world-weary vocal, you know? But then there's a little contradiction as the chorus bursts into major chords and sounds happy and upbeat. So right away, it juxtaposes itself. You can't help but love that. And then the fact that the title track, Tolerance Ends, is a great radio-friendly track. And, you know, it sounded to me, to the naked ear, like brass and strings. It may have been synthesized brass and strings, but it helps to build the nature of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And in this track, they've done the Pixies a solid, because they do the quiet, loud, quiet thing to a T. So this is a really, really nice piece. It's worth checking out and sitting and listening to a few times because it's a grower.
Yeah.
And if once it's a grower, then it stays with you. And that's what makes it work at the end of the day.
Yep. So again, the band is the Pinkerton Raid, and they are, I mean, in terms of that Sunshine Pop thing, the other thing about them is there's a lot of them. I think there's 7 or 8 people in this band. So
it is indeed an octet.
There we go. Yeah. So there's a lot of work being done by a lot of people who seem to have a real talent for it. So definitely check out the Pinkerton Raid. It's, as we said, elsewhere on popdose.com. You can find the review of their new record. And we want to move to D.W. Dunphy and some of the things that he's given us over the course of this week, because one of the things that he delved into goes into music and the other one doesn't. But we'll start with the musical one, because Levi Thomas is a guy that caught D.W.'s eye. So tell us a little bit about this and how he ended up on the page.
Well, D.W. apparently really likes his music a lot and interviewed him, actually. This was his interview with Levi. It was Listening Booth. That's D.W.'s section for interviews. He's considered a West Coast psychedelic folk crooner. And this is his first album. So, you know, he's had this audience building up, right? D.W. twigged it pretty quickly with him, and I think that's why he wanted it. It's almost like we're breaking him before anybody else does.
Yeah.
At least I'd like to think so. And, or I should say Popdose, we as Popdose as a collective. What got me interested is D.W.'s description. I mean, bringing up names like Calexico and Giant Sand, you know, that just screams to me, yep, Americana, and then some.
Right.
Because if you've listened to either or, you know what that sounds like. And from this interview, certainly he seems like from the written version of it, he seems like a very affable kind of guy and very forthright. So there's none of that, I'm being interviewed, so I want to be dark and moody and mysterious and sound like I'm a rural poet, pulling a combination of Bob Dylan vagueness and bullshit and, you know, aping all the other horrible cliches that always seem to come up. I mean, here's a great question, you know. Dunphy asked him point blank, is a song an easier place to be quasi-autobiographical or harder? And the upshot of the answer was, I spent the better part of my 20s in heavy rock bands screaming about how my brains were melting through my eyeballs. I love that. That's unfettered. That's direct. That's honest. You know, everybody nowadays, if you've noticed in print interviews, they're so well rehearsed and so poised. And while I can appreciate the professionality of many of these interviews, I find them to be so phony and so rote. And just so phony. And this was a really refreshing moment to see someone who's already been picked out as being something fairly special, given a chance to be interviewed on a fairly, you know, substantial site or music service, or actually I'd just like to call this a pop culture service. And I think it was a really great conversation between the two, and it makes you want to hear the album as soon as it comes out. It's like, okay, gimme.
Yeah,
I must hear it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you made the comparison with Dylan. He looks a little bit like a young Bobby Dylan. He certainly doesn't sound very much like him, but the other thing is he's a Midwestern guy. He's from Missouri and moved to the West Coast and has been making his bones there, as you said. So he's got a little bit of that sensibility to him, and I think that, you know, if I had a guess, I would say there wasn't much of a pause for thought before he answered these questions. You're right. It seems, even reading the words on the page, a very natural progression from question to answer.
And that's what I liked about it. But then again, D.W. has this way with people that when interviewing them, he puts them at ease.
Yep.
So it's not like you're having to extract the answers. It isn't a chore. I mean, I haven't done that many interviews, and the ones that I figured were going to be difficult turned out to be the easiest. One of the ones that I presumed, rightly or wrongly, might be easy was the hardest. So there you go. You can never predict. But
nope.
Like I said, because this young man has not been all over the place, as it were, he has a chance to still maintain his sense of joy at doing this and the newness of it. you know?
Yeah, so you can definitely get on the ground floor with Levi Thomas and do so through that conversation with D.W. Dunphy. There's some music there for you on the page as well, as there always is, some added something or other, whether it's video or music or both sometimes, in the articles that you find elsewhere on popdose.com. The other subject that D.W. took on in a column this week is Nolan Bushnell. And for those of us who were still kids as the 70s turned to the 80s, Nolan Bushnell, even if we didn't know his name back then, had probably a bigger influence on us than any other single person in the United States. So for people who don't know the name Nolan Bushnell, who was he?
I'm going to preface this by saying I am one of the very, very, very tiny minority who never played video games beyond his initial creation, Pong.
Wow.
Nolan Bushnell is the founder of Atari. Fascinating guy.
Yeah.
And if anybody really wants to get a good in-depth understanding of him and the whole Atari mania or craze or whatever you want to call it, you have to see that wonderful documentary, Game Over.
Yes.
For Atari. That's a must. Again, I never played video games, but I love that documentary.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He founded Atari in the early 70s. He escaped Atari when, in his own words, it started to become too much of a corporate culture once Warner came in, Warner Communications, which certainly Warner Communications, I think, was the direct cause of the demise of Atari. I think that whole story about E.T.
Oh, it was long over. Yeah, by then, yeah, it was written.
Projections are everything. It had nothing to do with E.T. because you came up with the sales projections by the time E.T. was just hitting the market.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fallacy.
Right.
He got out and wanted to kind of get back to the essence of doing something on a smaller level for kids that would give them joy, but it also had to do with the video games. And he helped create this odd mixture of a video game showcase / pizza parlor for smaller kids called Chuck E. Cheese.
Went from Atari to Chuck E. Cheese. Crazy.
And yet, and by the way, he had some serious, serious, I wouldn't say competitors, but imitators, because in New Jersey, when we go over to either shop or go to the movies, there was a place called Razzmatazz, which was completely based on the whole Chuck E. Cheese premise.
Oh, there was also Showbiz Pizza right around the same time? Sure.
You know, all these places with, you know, life-size puppet shows and you know, a video arcade and, you know, your table service for, okay pizza. Being a New Yorker, you're never going to hear a good word out of me for anything that's not from new within the five borough perimeter.
Yeah.
Even if you're in Long Island, forget it. You know, it's got to be the five boroughs. Otherwise, pizza's not pizza. It's fucking Domino's.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to go from Atari to Chuck E. Cheese, at least he's someone who was wise enough to see something bad is coming and I'm going to get out of here now. Plus, the whole atmosphere has changed.
Yeah.
And he went on and did something else. And, you know, it's substantial and it's still there. And it's interesting how the love and worship and respect of Atari remains to this day.
Oh, yeah.
That's sacred.
That is, and I saw a kid maybe 3 or 4 days ago, and I mean a kid probably 13, 14 years old, walking out of a mall wearing an Atari t-shirt. Now, I get why he was doing it, but still, just seeing that three-line logo, it made me a kid again. You know, it's just, there's something about that brand. And you're right. I mean, Warner was there and they bought Atari out by 1981, if I remember right. So it was still.
Yeah, 80, 81. And by the end of 83, it was all but over.
Yeah. And here's, I mean, they put out lousy product after lousy product. And I mean, I think E.T., the reason why I don't think that E.T. was the death knell is because I remember when Atari Pac-Man came out and it was so bad and so disappointing. And the craziest thing about that is that we all bought it and we all bought it for $50 a copy in 1981 dollars. And it was just insane to spend that kind of money on something that was shit. You know, it was that bad.
I didn't play video. You know, I'd occasionally pop a quarter in here and there. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, we had Pong when it came out, but I lost interest in that. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I played Asteroids and Space Invaders, you know, in the arcades when the graphics were good.
Right.
Ataris looked like shit, which is why I didn't like them. I thought they looked so cheap and so poor, and I just thought, well, I'm not going to have my parents waste money on this. This is something I don't need. And that's, you know, when you play Atari Pac-Man versus real Pac-Man, forget it. It's not even a comparison.
Exactly.
I mean, Asteroids, I always remember calling, you know, Atari's version Hemorrhoids, you know, because I was an infantile dickhead. But, you know, it was just shitty. It was really badly done. But the thing with E.T., I really don't like the way people overdid it with Howard Washaw and pointing the finger at him and saying, you're the reason why Atari disappeared.
Yeah.
No, it was first of all, think about the way he did it. I know we're getting away from Nolan Bushnell, but think about the way he went about doing this game. And you're talking about it in terms of 1982 context. You're sanctioned by the film's creator, Steven Spielberg, to do a video game and told by your boss that you have a 5-week turnaround time. That is so reminiscent of being at the record labels and being told, well, we need this album in time for the September return to school. You know, we have it already announced as an October 1st street date, and you're still fucking around in the studio with demos back in August. That is complete. What he did was a Herculean task.
Right.
He did it. He made it work, and fair is fair. He gave it to Spielberg. He ran it by him. Spielberg tried it. Spielberg played it, and he approved of it.
Yeah, and it wasn't that bad. It wasn't good, but it wasn't that bad. When you compare it to, like we were talking about, like the Atari Asteroids game, and compare that to what was in the arcade, compare Pac-Man to what was in the arcade, Berserk, any of them, they were so god-awful. So, yeah, E.T. came out, and it wasn't the home run that they wanted. That was all you could say about it, but it became hip to hate its guts.
You know, it's funny. It also reminds me of the death of Creation Records. Because, yeah. you know, they buried this video game, yep. You know, all the returns. Oasis, Be Here Now is the cause of death for Creation Records.
Right, except. So, yeah, it's a fascinating story, and Bushnell's part of it is as well. And I'll tell you what, this, I don't know if the book has ever been written, but if you're looking for a book to write, here's a little tip for you. There's another guy who is like the photo negative of somebody like Nolan Bushnell. Because Bushnell was not an operator. He was just a guy that had some vision and a joy for what he was doing. The photo negative of him is a guy who was there at the beginning of Red Lobster. Helped create the chain. And he ran a single standalone restaurant that had all kinds of rumors flying around about mob ties and everything else in Tampa. Back in 1979 or 1980, his name is Gene Holloway, and he ended up faking his own death, disappearing for years before being rediscovered in Canada. It's such a bizarre spy story, and I don't know that anybody's ever written the book, but yeah, Gene Holloway is one of those characters that more should be known by more people about.
Maybe you should sit down and write that book.
Maybe I should.
You know? By the way, just as a complete full disclosure and confessional, if you will, why I hate video games the most
is because
in the days of 2 minutes hate, the early days, and granted, this is by 1983, and obviously Atari was on its last legs. All right, unbeknownst to my parents, even though I'm 52 now, I don't live at home, and both of my parents are not here. We used to blow off school. You know, I'd blow off college classes. You know, I would say goodbye to my mother, but secretly I had already lowered my guitar out my window,
yeah. And
it was in the yard. I'd say goodbye to her, make sure she closed the door, and then I'd walk around the back of the house, pick up my guitar, and I'd go meet the rest of the guys who I was already in college, and they were just finishing high school. But we'd all meet up for really, you know, rehearsals when we all should have been in classes. And there would be points where we would take a break, and we'd head over to the local mall in a place called Time Out. And Mark, our bass player, would always play the same fucking game. And I can never remember what it's called, but it was a boxing game. And he would just go, body blow,
punch
body
out.
Body blow.
It's called
left, uppercut, knock him out.
Yeah, that was
nuts is what it would do. Hence, I hate video games because it was like a drug addict.
Right.
Watch him feed the habit. The 50 cents would go in, and he'd be in there like a madman. And all I kept hearing in my head was, body blow, body blow, body blow, left, 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 uppercut, knock him out. It's like Rock'em Sock'em fucking robots on a video game.
Pretty much. So the game was called Punch-Out. And let me see if I can go through your opponents, because they all had crazy names. So the first one was Glass Joe. And then the second one was Piston Hurricane. And then Bald Bull was the third one. The fourth one was Kid Quick. Then Pizza Pasta. And the last one, the champ, was Mr. Sandman.
All the members, they all look like fucking Mike Mazurki. You know? They all had...
Yes.
Only listeners who are of our age range are going to know who that is, and I'm not saying any more than that.
Perfect.
But they all had the fucking flat top and the big, the underbite.
Just crazy. Well, yeah, and I will give you, that game was probably about the most annoying to listen to, but I tell you, it was a lot of fun to play. So I'm with your bass player on that one.
It would permeate the whole arcade.
Yeah.
I would actually go, okay, yeah, geek that I am, would go and play the fucking Star Wars game because A, you could sit in it, and B, you're flying it.
Yeah,
you
know? Right.
So, and let's face it, I'm a fourth level Jedi. You think I'm not going to be able to fly this fucking thing and blow this Death Star? Who are we kidding? Come on.
Right. Yeah. And I still don't know what those little things you were shooting off the tops of the towers were, but it didn't matter. It was still a great game. The thing about the ambience of walking by the game room before Punch Out, when you walk by in that corridor outside the game room in the mall, and you could hear that cacophony of asteroids usually cut through because it had that really high pitched shoot, you know, the fire button sound, and you could hear a couple more of them, like the Pac-Man noise would come through, but there was just this great thing that happened when all of those games were going on at once. And the only place that I remember it being captured was in Joe Walsh's Space Age WizKids, because he plays a little bit of that video game arcade noise in the over the middle eight. Space Age WizKids. Just, you know, again, every time I hear that song, I think, you know, I remember being there when that happened.
One thing that was really interesting, though, at Time Out was that there was always really great-looking girls there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There was a definite atmosphere. And yet, you know, girls were hanging out and playing video games, too.
Yep.
Which was something of an impetus to at least be there and look cool.
Definitely. Know? Definitely.
Except for me banging my head against the game whenever I hear, body blow, body blow, body blow, left, left, left. Knock him out.
Oh, man. Hey, you know, anyway, now I'm going to have to go play Punch-Out again. But, yeah.
I want to take a second because we do need to talk about one other thing musically. And
yes.
This is important because it happened yesterday. And, of course, I think you know what I'm about to bring up. And that is the very, very sad passing of Greg Allman.
Definitely.
And, you know, I think we all knew something wasn't right when he started canceling dates, which he had never done. And then suddenly he canceled an entire tour, and then word leaked out that he'd been put in hospice care. I don't think any of us, and actually I'm happy to say that I think I've seen more wonderful tributes and words of warmth and love and appreciation for the music that he made yesterday by people who were always part of that punk pantheon that always, you know, denied and decried everything that went before. But look, there's a picture of me on Pop Dose wearing my Allman Brothers t-shirt because I don't give a shit. You know, I loved that band. You know, when I was 8 years old, Ramblin' Man came out as a single, and I actually still have it. I do still have, that's one of the 45s that's, you know, has survived the decades of my youth on the White Capricorn Atlantic Records label. You know, I still have Eat a Peach and Brothers and Sisters. You know, the fact is, If you saw the Allman Brothers, certainly none of us are old enough to have seen them with Dwayne or with Barry Oakley still in the group.
Yeah.
But for those of us who have seen the Allman Brothers, that was a band performance like nobody's business. They could play and they gave it everything. And it wasn't just a quick little, you know, 30 minutes to 40 minutes perfunctory set. You got a show for a couple of hours and you left feeling really, really enriched because it was so much fun. It was such a joyful, soulful experience. It almost borders on what you and I talked about a couple of weeks ago, that concept of a musical religious experience.
Yeah. Yeah, that spirituality, no doubt. And I've got just a couple of quick things to add to that, because every opportunity, and I never had the pleasure of talking with Greg, although we do have a mutual friend in Dave Hinson from Killer Vintage Guitars, and I know he's real broken up about this as well. But every opportunity I've had to talk to somebody who was even, you know, loosely related to the Allmans family has been a joy. I've had many conversations with Warren Haynes. He's a terrific human being. And the new Government Mule album, by the way, I'll plug that because it's also real good. Derek Trucks is just one of the nicest kids in the entire world, not to mention being an incredibly talented guitar player. But all of them have in common that feeling that you were talking about earlier with D.W. Dunphy, where you talk to them and they make you feel at ease. They're just nice, genuine, talented, but totally unassuming guys. And I mean, I can see why there was such a great love and affection for the fans for that band and for all of the band members for each other. And the other thing is, one of those loose lines of relation is Devin Allman is a guy that I've run into a time or two. And I happened to be at a wedding yesterday, and the guy who plays guitar in Devin Allman's band was there performing, just solo acoustic, just, you know, doing songs up on stage and everything. And nice guy, again, really talented musician. His name is Tyler. And at one point in the evening, without stressing it or putting any attention on it or anything else like that, he played Midnight Rider. And you could tell who had heard, because among the adults that were there for the wedding during the reception, when he played Midnight Rider, there was that collective sigh, that letting out of breath. It's like, ah, oh, yeah, Greg's gone. And it was very tasteful. It was great of him to do that. And it was just that moment for us. We kind of looked around and you could see who was having a tear brought to their eye by that.
What's also nice in seeing so many different perspectives and tributes and whatever you want to call it to Greg Allman, the kind words that were spoken about him, basically, from what I could gather, the man was loved.
Yep.
And well respected, and was just a genuinely nice, kind, decent person. You know, yeah, he had his demons, he battled them successfully, and that's that. Who doesn't?
You right. Know?
So I really bristle when people start to zone in on that, especially when the news is still fresh. And this is something that I really appreciate, the fact that you brought it up in one of your postings on Facebook, how people have this sense of needing to say things that they just shouldn't say. You know, keep your fucking mouth shut. Show a little dignity and a little respect. You're an adult and you're acting like you're in a schoolyard again at the age of 8. You know, whether or not you didn't like the Allman Brothers, there are a lot of people that did.
Yeah.
Don't sit there and go on about, you know, well, isn't the Allman Brothers the reason why punk rock was created? Shut up.
Right.
Right. Just keep it to yourself. You know, I don't have time for that, and I don't have respect for that. And for those people, I'm going to give them a serious rethink, because it's kind of part and parcel of who they are, and I just don't really need shit like that to see that on my page. You know, I love the Allman Brothers. It's very sad that Greg Allman is gone. Once again, hammers home the fact that time is short and life is cruel, and you know, we only have just so much.
That's right. So you got to enjoy yourself while you have the opportunity to do it. And we've got a couple more things to go over. And one of them, believe it or not, is, you know, again, it goes back into yet another musical genre that we haven't talked about yet on the show this time around. But you and I both love the Soul Serenade column on Popdos. And it takes on a couple of, boy, that time when soul was turning into sort of the edges of disco around the mid-70s. Where do we go with this one?
Well, the thing is, you know, by There's a big question mark. You know, when did soul become funk?
Yep.
First of all,
right.
You know? Now, when we're talking about funk, we're talking about the F-U-N-K funk. We're talking about the kind of super groovalistic process funkstication funk. We're talking about the Black Moses funk, hot buttered soul funk. We are talking about W-E-F-U-N-K, we funk, as personified by P-Funk, brought to us by none other than Dr. Funkenstein himself, the one and only Mr. Motor Booty,
George Clinton.
The Funkadelic All-Stars, who included, of course, Bootsy.
Yes.
Now, Flashlight. Let's talk about Flashlight. You know, you can talk about it. I grew up as a P-Funk fan. I loved P-Funk from the moment that I actually heard, and it wasn't, it wasn't Up for the Downstroke. It was, my first introduction was the title track, Mothership Connection.
Right.
You know, that whole, what was it, 12-minute suite? You know, welcome to WEFUNK, We Funk, coming to you live from the Mothership. That is my introduction. I mean, it doesn't... When you've had that, everything else is kind of on a lower tier. But okay, Flashlight is one of the best get down songs, and I mean get down songs of all time. Consider P-Funk to have kept themselves in the perimeters of what the standards of funk should be. They are the standard bearers of what funk should be and what funk is. Because by the mid to late 70s, you got it where it was starting to go into disco. But for those who were the old timers and the long drivers like P-Funk and like the Commodores, they didn't go into the disco round. They stayed funky. You know, yeah, they got a little cutesy with you once, twice, three times a lady. Meaning Commodores, not P-Funk.
Right.
But, you know, Flashlight, that song's a motherfucker.
Yeah.
You know, especially at the time that it came out. Now, on the flip side, Brick House.
Yes.
That song, that's a song to make your dick hard. I don't care who you are. I don't care how old you are. That song makes your dick hard. Because that is just, you want to talk about, if you thought Flashlight was a get down, this one's a get up, get down.
Mm-hmm.
You are going to get your fuck on with that song, because that is a motherfucker times two. And I absolutely love both songs. So when it comes to, again, we are entering the wheelhouse of my joyous youth, musically speaking, you know, the mid 70s. Are just a golden time, and so many wonderful records are being thankfully rediscovered by newer generations and being rediscovered by those of us who sort of willfully forgot them.
Yeah.
Okay. Ken is an incredible writer and knows exactly what he's talking about, so we're not going to say anything new in expounding upon what he has to say, but he picked two great songs.
Yeah, he did.
Songs, yeah.
So, and thank you to Ken Shane for that, and also for some great memories, because at the time when those songs came out, the place where I was most likely in suburban Buffalo to run into music like that was at the roller skating rink. But the other place was, there was a guy who used to drive our van to summer camp when I was, probably 7 or 8 years old. His name was Tony, and he was the head counselor at the camp, and he played some of the best music in that van my youth is encapsulated in that. And one of the things he loved the most was great funk. And we certainly didn't get it on WKBW. We got that stuff in Tony's van, but those kinds of memories, again, that's the stuff that sticks with you forever. And every time I hear both of those songs, that's where I go back to, is I'm on my way to camp or on my way home in the afternoon.
Well, that's part of what I love about these conversations, because like they're supposed to be, music is supposed to bring back a memory of hopefully joy first and foremost.
Yep.
And those periods, suddenly I'm getting older, suddenly I'm 13, 14 years old, and school dances, they played Brick House, you know.
Right.
And you're wearing your shiny silk shirt because you want to impress the ladies, you know. I mean, look, there's a huge comparison here. You've got fucking P-Funk. You've got Flashlight. Listen, you could play Up for the Downstroke. You could play Tear the Roof Off the Sucker. You know, fuck, you could even play One Nation Under a Groove. You can play Brick House. You play fucking Rubber Band, man. It goes right downhill right there because the Spinners don't have the funk.
No.
They're not funky. I'm sorry. It's a good song, but they're not funky.
Yeah.
But not funky, like, you know, Ain't No Stopping Us Now is funky.
Right. And at the same time, I mean, you had that absolutely miserable Sgt. Pepper movie that came out with the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton in it. And what did you say?
I'm losing the connection. Where you said there was a Sgt. Pepper movie, 1978, in which the Bee Gees played the Peppers and Peter Frampton played
Billy Shears. Yeah.
And Robert Stigwood sank an entire company by doing this.
Right.
I'm sure I was just hearing things because my memory doesn't work that way, John.
But see, here's the thing, is even in that dog awful movie that my sister dragged me to, because having a sister 5 years older than you is dangerous, and she had a thing for Peter Frampton because everybody did at that time, is that the only 3.5 minutes of that movie that's worth watching is when Earth, Wind, and Fire comes out and blows it apart.
Now see, Earth, Wind, and Fire, funk.
Yes.
And I don't care if they got a little soft. You know, September, that is a song I can listen to over and over and over again.
Yep.
Now, there's this little sliver of room between the wall that is funk, the almighty funk, and the shitty fortress of disco. And there's some great disco. There was some really great – Chic were great.
Yep.
Chic were not funk. Chic were disco.
Right.
Heatwave were fucking great. They kind of could have been funky, but they were more disco. Boogie Nights is kind of the gray area.
Mm-hmm.
But then Nights and Forever was every goddamn prom song, you know. But still, Boogie Nights kind of is in that kind of netherworld. But, you know, you got the shitty disco. I'm sorry, Tavares, not funky.
Yeah.
You know, they're criminals. They're, you know, the Bee Gees, circa, anything from... Well, anything after I'll really grace them on this one. I'll give them from the album 2 years on was the last Bee Gees album as far as I am concerned, because mm-hmm. I think it's the album that had Lonely Days. That's the last. Trafalgar, because that's the album that had How Can You Mend a Broken Heart. So I'll grace them that. After that, no Bee Gees.
Right.
Because Bee Gees equals you know what, and I don't want to talk about it. So it'll make me even more hostile than I get. So, you know, you want to talk about the funk? Yes, let us talk about the funk. Let us stick with Brick House. Let us stick with – those are the anthems of funk.
Mm-hmm.
Let us stick with Flashlight. Let's stick with any fucking thing that Isaac did, you know. The funkiest thing that ever was is still always going to be the theme from Shaft.
Yep.
That right there. You say funk, you say theme from Shaft. Game over right there.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the song that gave us the most famous Waka Chia Waka Chia ever. Gotta love it, man. Well,
bad motherfucker.
That's right. Shut your mouth. Well, Ken Shane, again, thank you for the Soul Serenade column, and thank you for knocking it out of the park again elsewhere on Pop Dose. And we've got one more thing to talk about. We always end up with a little conversation about what's...
We also do have to bring up one more thing, which I'm loath to do because it's sad and negative, but we lost my favorite James Bond. We lost Roger Moore.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, he had a wonderful, long, glorious life. You know, he was originally tapped to play Bond.
No.
Because he was contracted to do The Saint on TV. That's why by default it went to Shaker, not Stark.
Yeah. Finished. Right, him and Lazenby. But, and it was, I mean, For Your Eyes Only is one that I saw in the theater. Man with a Golden Gun, I think, was the first Bond movie that I ever saw, and that was in the theater when it came out.
Yeah.
And just absolutely loved those movies.
My first in the theater was Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
You know, Wings title song notwithstanding.
Right.
It was my first one in the theater. And I got to admit, I kind of bristled at some of the later ones because, man, it was a good thing he was getting out by A View to a Kill. But it wasn't his fault. It was just lousy scripts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Right.
the fact that they had to go to Timothy Dalton because, like Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan had been tapped to play Bond next. And it was predicated on the fact that it had been announced NBC were going to cancel Remington Steele.
Yeah.
So he was free. And all of a sudden, when they found out that he was going to be playing Bond, we're bringing it back.
Yeah, they screwed him out of it for a couple more years.
They did. So, you know, he did. I thought he was the great natural choice for Bond, but the scripts they gave him were absolute shit.
Yeah.
And that just didn't sit well with me. But Roger Moore to me was the definitive Bond, because I always felt Connery was a little too hard. Bond to me was always supposed to be very suave, very, you know,
yeah,
not stud, you know, very, very elegant. I didn't feel Connery had the elegance that Roger Moore had. But, you know, if you watched The Saint in the 60s or his short-lived series with Tony Curtis, The Persuaders, then you knew this guy could only be one thing, and that is James Bond, yeah. You know, and through all these very poor substitutes, not knowing the fact that he had been chosen to play Bond. But, you know, he's a great actor. He had a great sense of comedy. And, he was much older now, but like so many others, he too will be missed. Oh, and by the way, the reason we haven't seen the sidekick Mika Brzezinski this week with Morning Joe Scarborough is because her father, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was part of Jimmy Carter's cabinet, passed away this week also. Mm. So it's another celebrity passing. Also two more lesser known passings. I apologize in advance, but the drummer from Megadeth died from a heart attack.
On stage.
Another one, which I find, that's now the third one. AJ Perro,
yep.
Sid Hashian, and now, I'm so sorry, I can't remember his name. And also yesterday, and it's ironic because I was watching Clerks when I saw the news, the woman who played Caitlin Bree in the original Clerks, Lisa Spoonhauer, passed away last week.
Oh, wow.
Suffering from various debilitating illnesses over an extended period of time, and she left behind a husband and daughter. And, you know, I saw it because a friend of mine posted on Facebook that everyone at the View Askew universe was devastated and Lisa will be missed. And I thought, are they talking about her?
Yeah.
You know, there's this beautiful little piece written by Kevin Smith. And, you know, someone somewhere said, well, don't ask Jeff Anderson anything about it, because he actually had been married to her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and he was just devastated as well. So a week of sad passings. And I wanted that to get out there because I don't think they would have gotten covered on a larger scale than, you know, Happiness Spotted in almost as an afterthought. And, you know, Clerks is a movie that's going to live with us for a really, really long time.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
I feel like Clerks 2 just a little better.
I'm bringing it back. We got to, one more thing to go over, and it goes to the In Our Head segment. This is something we look forward to every week when we get together for these conversations, because it just is exactly that. It's something that's been rattling around inside our crania for all week long. And the one thing that...
And it makes me think on my feet, damn it.
That's right. Yeah. So this time around, we're going to go into a little bit of censorship in an odd way, because I happen to hear the full version, the album version of Dire Straits from Brothers in Arms, of course, Money for Nothing. And it came as such a surprise to me, because it had been a long time since I'd heard the full version of that song. And when it got to that verse about the little faggot with the earring and the makeup, I thought, wow, I mean, I understand it was written in character, and it was a conversation that Mark Knopfler overheard with a couple of guys working in a store that he owned, and they didn't know he was who he was. So it's just these two guys watching MTV. So the song is written in character. Mark Knopfler's not calling anybody a faggot. So, but even so, it was taken out in the radio edit, the single version of that song. That verse wasn't there, and you didn't hear it on the radio much. And I thought, you know, it encapsulated a part of the moment that was the early days, the crazy days of MTV, and it really does belong in that song. And there are so many times that we have these songs that are a piece of our lives, And when you hear them on the radio, when they make that edit that they don't need to make because we all know what the real words to the song are, it seems like a crime. And I wonder if there's any of those that spring to mind with you.
The first one that immediately comes to mind was when I was a kid and Kodachrome came out as a single. And the opening verse, when I think back on all the crap that I learned in high school, that verse was almost never played on, certainly not on WNBC AM or ABC AM. Wow. I don't believe it was on ABC. I think I heard the full version on maybe 102.7 WNEW where Rock Lives, or maybe on 95.5 WPLJ. You actually heard it on the album, of course. But if you bought the single, and they never used to say single edit back then.
Right.
They used to just say single. The only time a song was, quote, given the single edit on the label was something like Mothership Connection was released as a 45, but it, because of time constraints, not because of lyrics, they cut half the song out.
Yeah.
Which would always drive you crazy, but that's not the topic at hand. Yeah, the word crap got taken out. I also remember not long after that, Elton John had a number one single with The Bitch Is Back.
Yes. Now,
this is a double-edged sword because they played the songs on the stations. They would never call the song, and that's Elton John's new single, you know, Cousin Brucey or Harry Harrison or Dandy Dan Daniels.
Right.
They would all try and, you know, DJ their way around it that with Elton John's new single. And they'd play it, but they'd never call it by name, but it wasn't censored. Now, there were times that I have heard, I didn't actually hear it, but The Ballad of John and Yoko, Christ, You Know It Ain't Easy, they would do the famous beep on the word Christ.
Really? Wow. Yeah, that I've never heard.
And that, well, keeping in mind that was 1969, so you couldn't say stuff like that.
True enough.
Now, this is one that really didn't get much airplay here, but okay, WLIR Radio, 92.7 from Smithtown, Long Island, which was the new wave punk radio station of the New York area in the early 80s, when they would play Beat Surrender by The Jam, the first verse, and I've never heard any kind of edit except for seeing a visual edit when they appeared on Top of the Pops, but the first verse goes, the bullshit is bullshit, it just goes by different names. And I've heard the song in full, played intact,
yeah,
without any kind of drops or, you know, silences, as it were.
The same is true of Money by Pink Floyd. I have never heard bullshit edited out of Money.
Yeah. Although to be fair, I've never heard Money played on any top 40 stations.
Yeah.
Always on rock radio, where you would always hear full versions of songs, you know, certainly, I've never heard anyone bleep out Working Class Hero by John Lennon.
Right.
Where he uses the word fuck how many times? Granted, you know, Lennon was trying to be hard. But Little TNA.
Yes.
By the Rolling Stones. Always got full-fledged airplay. There's right. No censorship there.
No, and tits and ass, really? Yeah, you know, if the one that I heard both ways, and it usually was the AM-FM split, like on the AM side, you would always hear Jet Airliner by the Steve Miller Band, and they changed it to Funky Kicks Going Down in the City, but if you listen to it on the FM rock stations, it was funky shit. And I don't know how much, I don't want to get too into the weeds on this, but what people should know is that you can still get fined. I mean, if you play Money by Pink Floyd and somebody records it and, you know, records you airing the word bullshit, they can report you to the FCC, and at their discretion, they can fine you for that. It doesn't happen much because most of the people listening to rock stations like that just sort of expect it. But if they decided to crack down, they could. And that's still really sad that they have people on music stations with songs that we've all known for 40 years, and they still have to worry about getting fined over this shit. It's crazy.
Well, you know, another good one was, because it was such a big hit in 1979, Good Girls Don't by The Knack.
Yes.
There's this one verse. It's in the middle of the middle eighth verse, right before the guitar solo, where, you know, it's a teenage sadness that you know you can't erase. The line is when she's sitting on your face, but somehow they changed it, and I never knew this because it's only recently that I heard the single edit.
Yep.
To what's the tidy version?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember.
To In Your Place.
Right. Yes.
That's what they switched it to. But you hear where he originally shouts it, and it hurts, you know, because you're supposed to take it in the proper context. I mean, God bless him. Doug Figure wrote some horny little bastard songs.
Oh, but, yeah, he did.
You know, I mean, Baby Talks Dirty, how that ever got played on radio at all is beyond me. She even got a girlfriend. She says, hurt me, hurt me.
Well, see, and the one that I will leave you with is this, that I was not old enough to be there for this, but my dad... In, you know, we always listen to the burgeoning FM radio when it first started out. And when, and I can't remember which album it was, maybe Surrealistic Pillow, when the Jefferson Airplane album came out that had We Can Be Together on it.
The Wall Motherfucker.
Up Against the Wall Motherfucker. And it also, early on in that song, it says, we are all outlaws in the eyes of America. In order to survive, we steal, cheat, lie, forge, fuck, hide, and deal.
We are all outlaws in the eyes of America.
But it's so fast that if you're not listening for it, it can go right by and you'll never hear it. But the motherfuckers thing. Yeah. It could be. But either way, that song did get airplay up until somebody said, hey, you know, she's saying up against the wall, motherfucker, in that thing.
Up against the wall.
Such a great tune.
Well, you know, it's funny. Let's go back just for the laughs of the flip, well, in the United States, the flip side of Paint It Black, Stupid Girl, which is a great song, but the lyric, she bitches about things that she's never seen.
Right.
You know, that's one. But let's just go to the ultimate statement in censorship, and we'll go right back to, what is it, 56, 57. Wake Up Little Susie was just outright banned and outlawed in Boston because it was about – just because they fell asleep.
Yeah, yep.
That just started a whole furor right there. So it depends on the audience. It depends on who has the itchy trigger finger on the censorship buttons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would rather hear a song just go silent for a millisecond than hear a bleep noise go through it.
Right.
I really don't care for censored versions or clean versions or edits or any of that kind of, you know, palatable shit. Just, you know, if you don't like it, don't listen to it. Don't buy it.
Right.
Let FM radio play it. Let now satellite radio play it, whatever the case may be. But, you know, I'm thinking about when we were kids and having to deal with these fucking song edits, what a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Basically half the song is over, you know. All of a sudden, you just go right into that second verse of Kodachrome, and you miss the whole point of the goddamn song.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking when you brought that up, is that just verse, you know, it's a wonder I can think at all. That sets the tone for the rest of the song. That tells you what he's talking about. And they have no feel for that. But, you know, at the end of the day, we all really know what the true title of the Rolling Stones Schoolboy Blues is. So, you know.
Or Star Star.
Yeah, right.
Which, isn't it funny? That song gets a lot of airplay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. But yeah, it just goes to show you there's no consistency, there's no sense to it, and that when you get into censorship, there's no sense to it anyway. It's just words, man. So, Rob Ross, at that, I'm out of material, brother. We've got a lot to cover, though. And I'll tell you...
I'll tell you what we can talk about for our wrap-up right here, and that's something that we haven't talked about, is the fact that the Nashville Predators are going to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yes.
And I hope. They absolutely make minced meat out of the Pittsburgh Penguins because, you know, the Preds lost their two top players. They lost their captain.
Yep.
Then they lost their top scorer, and they still managed to get to the finals. I want to see them put the hurt on Sidney Crosby like nobody's business. And while they're at it, let's take out Evgeny Malkin once and for all because he's such a little shit stain.
There you go.
I've always hated that little prick.
Yeah. Well, it's their 20th year, and I'll tell you, if you get the chance, whether it's on satellite radio or on cable or whatever, if you can find the Nashville feed of those games, Pete Weber is an old friend of mine, a wonderful guy, and he's one of the best voices in hockey. So if you can get the Nashville feed of any of those games, listen to Pete make those calls, and you'll enjoy it all that much more. So, yeah, absolutely, I'm with you. I'm pulling for them. They're in their 20th season. It's about time for them to get a cup victory. It would be really nice to see it go somewhere where it hasn't been before. And, you know, next week, by the way, I'll give you a little preview because Roger Klein of the X of the Refreshments, and for the last, boy, 20 years with the Peacemakers, they've got a new album that's coming out on the 30th of June, and I have not yet heard their first single off of it, but I know some people who have, and they tell me it's a barn burner. So we'll get to that, and I know you've got more coming up for us on Pop Dose this week.
Oh, absolutely, and next week you and I are going to talk at greater length once again about the Co-op Communique Volume 3, which actually was released on Friday. So it is now out, but I would like us to actually give it a bit more exposure because it's a wonderful collection.
Yes.
Yours truly being on it notwithstanding. You're welcome to play the track that's on there by me. You have my full creative license to do so. But it's a great compilation. And because it's so good, I want people to hear more of it and more about it. And yeah, just lots of stuff for us to talk about. There's always stuff for us to talk about, and I think next week's show should be just as much fun and if not more interesting as these all are. So yeah. On that note, I will bid you a fond farewell till next Sunday and when we record these shows, folks. And have a great week and have a great holiday tomorrow.
You do the same, my friend. And we'll do some more talking then. As you heard, lots coming up for our next conversation. We've also got everything else that's happening here on popdose.com for you to go and peruse. And there's always added material there for you on the page, some music to click on, some videos to watch. So do that. And we'll talk to you then on Radio City.